Ladies and gentlemen, we need a cooling off period. And I suggest that Mr. Ross Anderson is the right guy to give us this cooling off now. I have the great honor to present the very distinguished Ross Anderson, who leads the security group at the Computer Laboratory in Cambridge University, where he is a senior reader in security engineering. It's a great honor to have you here, Ross, and we are very, very impressed by your publications. Let me translate it in briefly in German. Wir haben die große Ehre, Herrn Ross Anderson mit der Cooling-Off-Period jetzt zu betrauen, nachdem die Emotionen ja sehr hochgekocht sind. Herr Anderson leitet die Sicherheitsgruppe des Computer Laboratory der University of Cambridge und ist dort Lektor im Bereich Security Engineering. It's your turn.
Thank you. Can you hear me all right? Good. The title of my talk is Cryptography and Competition Policy. There is a paper with full details outside. I won't have time to go through everything, but you can read it up afterwards. The theme of my talk is at least as much economics as technology. Over the last few years, we have seen that the fastest growing uses of cryptography and of information security technology in general have been applications that support particular business models. An early application of cryptography was copy protection in computer games consoles. All of the computer games vendors of any size now operate a business model in which software subsidizes sales of hardware. And so cryptographic mechanisms are used to prevent people writing software for these platforms unless they have signed a contract which causes them to pay royalty to the platform vendor. So this is the opposite of the PC environment. It's closed rather than open. Again, since about 5 years ago, mobile phone vendors have been using cryptography to tie the battery to the mobile phone. Motorola started it. If you try to put a cheap Korean battery in your Motorola mobile phone, you'll find that you cannot charge it in the phone itself. Why? Because there is a crypto challenge response that authenticates it. And also, over the last 5 years, the sellers of laser printers and some bubble jet printers have started putting cryptography in the ink cartridges. And again, their business model is that they make the money from the sales of the ink and use that to subsidize the printer. And there are all sorts of other tricks that these are used for to control the aftermarkets. For example, even if you have a genuine printer cartridge and you take it and you refill it, in many cases it will fail the authentication because there is a flange or a wire which is broken when you do the refilling. And also, we've recently found that Hewlett-Packard is selling ink cartridges with expiry dates. Recently, I found that the color printer in the corridor outside our office refused to print because the ink was out of date. Now, I think this is outrageous. This is our ink. We paid for it. We handed over the money. And now we can't use it because we haven't been using it fast enough. So this is leading to serious political problems. In America, the printer maker Lexmark has got an injunction, that is a court order, against a company, SCC, which makes replacement authentication chips for printer cartridges. So if you refill printer cartridges, you can buy chips from SCC which will make them work with Lexmark and Hewlett-Packard and other printers. Lexmark has persuaded a judge that this is a crime under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and they've got a court order to stop it. Meanwhile, here in Europe, our own European Parliament has decided that all printer cartridges must be refillable by the year 2006. This is an issue of environmental policy. So we are heading for a trade war with America on the use of cryptography to control aftermarkets. There are many related policy issues If we go back to the 1930s, we find that IBM used its patents on punch cards to extend its control of one area of business machines to another. And it can also be used, if you have got tying strategies, to link up two different products in a more modern environment, for example, the link between Windows and Office. Microsoft does not sell Office for Linux. The use of intellectual property between companies in patent pools also goes back a long time. IBM and Remington Rand in the 1930s used their patents on punch card technology to keep outsiders out of the office machine market. And in Britain, we had similar problems with car parts in the 1960s, where copyright and trademark law enabled companies like Ford to charge very, very high prices on car parts. In the end, after we joined the European Union, we had to pass a new copyright law in order to make secondary markets in car parts sensible. But what we're finding nowadays is that the car servicing problem is coming back, because the car vendors put software in your car, and the software talks to software in your garage. And so if you have a late model Ford and you try and have it serviced at a non-Ford dealer in America, you can have problems. Again, this leads to political rows. I personally got a Volvo 4 years ago, and now I find that although the local garage can do the servicing perfectly well, they cannot turn out the little nagging light which says service due. So now I have to drive all the time with this light flashing, telling me that I must get the car serviced. Incidentally, there will be a conference in Bochum in November run by Christoph Paar on electronic security in car. I have slides on
trusted computing, but I will zip through them very quickly because we have already heard from the vendors of trusted computing, or trustworthy computing if you're Microsoft, or treacherous computing if you're the Free Software Foundation. It is perhaps simplest just to call it TC. Thereby we avoid the ideological split, and you can pronounce TC however you prefer. It is perhaps important to note that TC is part of a broader program by a number of companies. Microsoft, for example, has introduced some TC features already in the Xbox in terms of software attestation, also some of the email security features are now supported in Windows Server 2003. So this is not a single moment when the computing architecture will change. It is a process. We are being taken to a destination for which I think we are beginning to have fairly detailed maps. You've seen the picture about how the hardware can be used to control the software. And although at the beginning of the trusted computing saga, the idea was that the trust would come from the bottom up through certification of the TPM, now the story is that the certification will come from the top down. It will be the application vendors who will decide what configurations of hardware are acceptable to run their code. But nonetheless, there is still going to be certification. Okay, what's TC good for? At the beginning, we had a number of explanations which have since evaporated. We were told, for example, that TC would stop spam because you could arrange to receive email only from trusted machines. Well, you can already have a whitelist in your mail client which will receive, you know, which will throw away all mail unless it comes from someone you know. That you can do already, but it destroys the value of email. So that's not an argument, and Microsoft has stopped making it. The second argument that they've stopped making, but that they did make in the beginning, is that it would stop viruses. Now, TC will enable you to be sure that the copy of Office you are running on your PC is a genuine copy of Office and that the license fee has been paid. It will not turn off scripting in Office, right? Now, in order to stop viruses, you have to turn off scripting. So if you want to stop viruses, why go to the trouble of having TC?
It's simpler just to disable scripting in all your desktop products, but that would diminish the amount of lock-in that these products have over corporate users who rely on them for EIS systems. Anyway, there are a number of explanations that also don't work, but which are still being used by TC protagonists. The ability to supply multi-level secure systems to government is one that we have heard more and more. If you read my book on security engineering, you'll see that there are many problems in principle with implementing MLS, and for that reason, many governments are drawing away from it. In America, there's an argument about the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, but again, the problems of implementing this are fundamentally not technical, but have to do with the nature of the business processes that have evolved in American hospitals, which are fundamentally insecure, which involve sharing medical information with lots of commercial companies. And as usual with data protection, the main threat to personal privacy is not the technical attack by an outsider, but the abuse of authorized access by an insider. Almost all medical privacy violations, for example, are of this type. The private detectives phones up the hospital library or your doctor's office, and he tells a plausible story about being a doctor involved in your care, and your doctor's secretary then reads out the relevant medical records over the telephone. That is how it happens. It's not something that technology stops, it's something that you can stop with training and with discipline. Okay, so what's TC good for? Well, the whole thing started out back in 1995 as being about digital rights management. Intel was worried that they would lose the command of the home, that the server in the home would not be something like a PC but something like a PlayStation. They believed that DRM would be the killer application, and so they decided that the PC had to support DRM. They then decided to bring in encryption, bus encryption, into the main processor line by 1999. They started as a first step to that with the Pentium serial number. As you know, that failed because of public protest, and the TCPA alliance was the beginning of that. As our colleague from Microsoft has pointed out, DRM is not indeed the killer application for TCPA. Media player already exists. On top of TC, it will be a little bit harder to hack, and it will open slightly wider the prospect of a PlayStation-like business model in which revenues from the sale of content subsidize the sales of platforms. In fact, I believe that TC is only really going to take off once you go into Walmart and you see a normal PC for $400 and a TC PC for $200. That is, you know, what will bring it into the mass market. And what will pay for that, of course, is the revenues from selling people songs on the TC platforms and exploiting all the other business revenues and rents that can be created. So DRM is just one application. And of course, there are many political objections that many of you are familiar with. There's a threat to the digital commons. There's a threat to fair use of copyright material by universities and libraries. There are issues of censorship because DRM systems need some means to track down and kill pirate content. And once you have a system that can track down and kill pirate content, it can be used by the courts to suppress bad content. You can see how this will go. There will be some particularly nasty child sex video, and a court will give an order saying that Windows Media Player must refuse to play this video, and then the Scientologists will say Media Player must not pay the Fishman affidavit, and it will just go on from there. There is also, I think, a more subtle problem with DRM being tied up with trusted computing, in that in the old days, like 3 years ago, the computer industry was aligned with the cause of freedom on one side, and you had Hollywood and the forces of darkness on the other. Now things have switched. All of a sudden, you have got the computer industry and Hollywood lined up together in favor of a control agenda, and on the other side, one finds
consumer advocates, liberty advocates, free marketeers, government competition authorities, there is a really profound political realignment going on. And that is going to have some very interesting consequences over the next few years. So what else is TC good for? Well, we have heard from Microsoft about enterprise rights management. As one of the questioners said from the floor, Bill Gates had a famous quote in which he said, "We came at this looking at music, and then we realized that email was far more interesting." So Microsoft policies internally, according to my spies, are that internal emails should vanish after 90 days. This means that in future, if Microsoft is sued by the by Mario Monti or by the Federal Trade Commission or whatever, there will be fewer embarrassing emails to be got through the discovery process. So there are all sorts of facilities that TC will offer to corporate users. In fact, Windows 2003 Enterprise Edition is already supporting many of these. You can send an email that a recipient cannot forward. You can send an email that the recipient cannot even print. You can send an email that a recipient needs a secret clearance to read. You can send an email that you can recall later if you decide that it was a mistake. You can send an email that your boss can recall if it's embarrassing. So if you leak details of an internal accounting scandal, perhaps to your company's internal audit division, or to the Federal Ministry for Economics and Labour, and the boss finds out about this and decides that it wasn't a good idea, then he can press a button and the email vanishes. Where is the evidence now? And you can do things like sending emails that can only be read until the end of the week. Now, this can be done already in software, but TC will make the mechanisms harder to defeat. The police computer forensics laboratories are going to have to spend many millions of euros on probing stations, focused ion beam workstations, and other equipment so that they can hack hardware and get evidence out of TC machines. There are also going to be many policy complexities. For example, under the EU dual use directive, which regulates the export of technologies that have a military application, there is a requirement that many emails concerning intangible technology transfers be kept for 2 years. So, if Microsoft sends an internal email from Berlin to Redmond that contains some cryptographic source code, then European law says that that email must be kept for inspection by the federal authorities for 2 years. And if Microsoft's internal rules say that all internal emails must be destroyed after 90 days, then Microsoft is a lawbreaker. How is your company going to deal with policy conflicts like that? Making a mechanism like TC available is going to put temptation in a lot of people's way. The second and third order effects of this are going to be very complex indeed. And this is one of the reasons why mandatory access control schemes in the military have tended to be more trouble than they're worth. Much of human society depends on people acting with common sense. And when you try and reduce all of common sense to hard, unbreakable rules, then all of a sudden a lot of your business processes break. There's also an issue of policy tussles between firms. Suppose that you have a law firm. Suppose you are a lawyer. At present, you receive emails from your clients giving you instructions. Go and sue IBM. Go and sue Microsoft, whatever. If you are a partner in a law firm, you want to keep access to these emails for 6 years in case somebody sues you. So if a client sends you a protected email saying, do this, and you can only read it for 90 days, then that is unsatisfactory. Also, if the client sends you an email which you can read for 6 years, you and your partners, that still doesn't help you completely, because suppose in 5 years' time you now decide that you're going to switch from using Office on top of Windows to using OpenOffice with OpenDRM and on top of TC Linux. You now find that you have emails from perhaps 10,000 different client companies. You have to migrate these emails. How do you do that? Hey, the emails belong to the people who created them. If you want to migrate that email, you have to go to the client TC. What happens there is that you have a choice of only two security vendors for the conditional access scheme for the set-top box. And so if you run a cable TV station, once you go for one vendor or the other, you're completely locked in. How do firms behave? Well, research shows that cable TV firms are largely able to negotiate a discount from the vendor, which compensates them for the direct economic cost of lock-in. However, they are unable to do anything about innovation. Because there is a duopoly, the market is stagnant, the vendors aren't doing anything to develop the technology, and so the cable TV business is under threat from satellite TV, the internet, and elsewhere. So here is a real documented case of where moving from an open to a closed system really harms innovation. Conclusions. Well, my view is that information security is starting to face, if you like, an ethical crisis, rather like physics in 1945. Until 1945, physics was good, and more physics was better. There were never any doubts about it. And then, boom, all of a sudden the physicists were splitting into two camps. There were those who worked for the weapons labs, and there were those who went on marches through the streets. We haven't quite got to that point with InfoSec, but it may be getting that way. Why? Because InfoSec mechanisms are not being used in practice to do things that one intuitively regards as good, socially friendly things like protecting privacy. They're being used to support all sorts of business models that people are uncomfortable with, monopolies, product tying, aftermarket control, and so on. Now, the growing tensions make regulatory interest inevitable. The regulatory interest is there. This is going to change the nature of our business. TC, if it succeeded without regulatory constraints, would itself change the nature of our business, because instead of having an open platform that we've had up till now, the PC will become more like multiple virtual PlayStations. And so there's a whole bunch of issues there, but I think that for regulators and for government, the central issue is going to be the competition policy issue. Will TC help or hinder competition? What will the effects be on innovation and on economic growth? And in order to sort this sort of thing out, technical discourse isn't enough. Claims and counterclaims of product features don't cut it. One needs economic analysis. Fortunately, over the last few years, we have been developing the economics of information security, and we can begin to provide some pointers. We have an annual conference in the field, and we certainly believe that we'll be the world's economics ministries on these. Thanks.
In English,
business people
are frozen out. Suppose you're a musician who sings songs in Icelandic, right? There's only 270,000 people speak Icelandic. That's not a big enough market for Sony or AOL Time Warner to be interested in. Will you be able to get your songs digitally recorded at all? This is the kind of toxic spillover that you can expect if power in the platform end of things becomes translated into power in the content end of things.
The cross-subsidization mechanism within trusted computing markets, is there any?
Well, it seems clear to me that at the moment, Microsoft's platform business is essentially subsidizing the Office business, because you know they're spending money which will result in greater profits for Office later. Within one company, that's not a big deal. If they were two separate companies, then, I mean, same result by negotiating transfer payments.
but I don't know whether that